Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to morning. The live science radio show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julian Paul here live later in the show. We'll be talking to RPG. But there's no guest speaker this week. Phil couldn't be with us, unfortunately. Next week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, we're hoping Dr. Ogo Osamo will be back with us. Let's see, he's back after his summer recess, putting his feet up. I don't think so, really. Lots of things to talk about today. First up, I'm just going to remind people of the Discover Me study. So that's www.discovermestudy.com. It's a nationwide research study analysing health and genetic information to transform patient care. It predicts who's likely to develop disease. It's trying to improve disease diagnosis, to get a better understanding of how diseases progress, and of course to discover new treatments. Now, the study is run by Omingen, which is a research and development company run by senior academics from the University of Cambridge, working closely with GPs and NHS research nurses. Participants provide a DNA sample, it's just a mouth swab or a saliva sample, and the genetic information from that DNA sample is analysed alongside your medical records. It's an interesting study, so check it out. And just to remind you that next Saturday, even though Phil can't be with us today, it's the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society Astronomy Night at, guess where? The Camellia House, Wentworth Woodhouse, Preservation Trust in Rotherham. Great event. It runs from 7 o'clock until around 9:30. So you'll have to get tickets for that. It's a ticketed event. And whilst it's a bit of a way off, Sheffield Photographic Society have got their Perspectives exhibition. This year's Perspectives exhibition coming up again. It's free. It'll be in the Sheffield Winter Gardens. It runs from 12 noon on Friday the 1st of November until 3 p.m. on Sunday the 10th of November. It's all good stuff. Next up, it's a couple of local stories. Oh, interesting.
Yes, huge RHS climate change survey, a new RHS project with the University of Sheffield and Reading is asking gardeners to share experiences of how climate change is affecting plants and gardening habits. RHS PhD student Ellie Kamilski has developed a survey to gauge how gardening is changing and which plants are proving the most resilient. We've noticed some weird stuff in our garden as well.
We have indeed.
And I did see a wasp this morning in our front door, which was very unusual.
Yeah, I've not seen much this year.
No. So to take part, visit rhs.org.uk/climate change survey by 15th of October.
So not long left, 10 days to do that. The next story, it's a bit of a double story because the Sunday Times University of the Year, they publish a supplement every year on the best universities. And the runner-up for best university this year has been the University of Sheffield, which is amazing. I think it lost out to the London School of Economics, I think. But this is interesting. So the University of Sheffield attracted record applications in 2023, 43,665, and is enjoying soaring rates of student satisfaction, partly thanks to an award-winning students' union. But it's not all about that. The academic clout of the University of Sheffield is well known. Six Nobel Prize winners among its former students and staff, and I didn't know that, so I thought, wow. Also, I didn't really know that the University of Sheffield pioneered the medical use of penicillin in 1930, and the university continues to shape the modern world. It's highly regarded advanced manufacturing research centre, which is based in Rotherham. It's off the Parkway. Researches sustainable fuels, while the Translational Energy Research Centre is looking into carbon capture technologies. Now, alongside all that, the Heritage Collection at University of Sheffield offers students access to rare books, artworks and exhibits at two campus museums. Now, one we've been to, the Turner Museum of Glass, it's amazing. And one we haven't been to, the Alfred Dennett Museum of Zoology. So,
yes,
yeah, amazing.
That?
We'll have to find out. But on that note, I also picked up another story. It was, I think it's on the BBC, actually. It was entitled My Apprenticeship Has Set Me Up for Life.
Yes, a newly qualified engineer says his decision to pursue an apprenticeship over a traditional university degree has left him set up for life. Alex Winfrey Gibson, who's 22, completed an engineering degree apprenticeship at the University of Sheffield's Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, or AMRC, and is now encouraging others to sign up. Apprenticeships combine work and study with participants receiving a wage and having their tuition fees paid for by the government and their employer. Mr. Winfrey Gibson said, "You are earning money and you are really setting yourself nicely, not only for the rest of early adulthood, but for the rest of your life." He said, "If you are doing your traditional degree, you should get a bunch of knowledge and not a lot of skill, and your workplace experience is completely neglected, whereas with an apprenticeship, you're getting all three. When you come out of your degree, you are far more employable because you either already have a job or have 3 years of experience to find a new job." He also said he had also benefited from the connections made during his apprenticeship, as well as learning other valuable life skills. "You are 3 years ahead in your career, your earning potential is higher than other graduates, and you are learning life skills. The Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, AMRC, wants to encourage more female students to become apprentices."
Indeed. So these modern apprenticeships, they're very important. So Louise Cowling, who's head of apprenticeship at the AMRC, and she sets the programmes up and delivers them, said they were particularly keen to hear from female applicants. She said about 12% of our intake are women, which is about the national average for females employed in manufacturing. "We are working hard along with a lot of the employees that we work with to increase female participation, and we start very early. I think there is almost a bias where some girls think engineering and manufacturing is not for them. But if they have the aptitude, the interest, the ability to problem solve, they will enjoy technology." Another interesting one, Lisa Wild, who teaches engineering at Doncaster University Technical College, said more female students should consider the sector. "Engineering and manufacturing does not tend to be on their radar, but I do think the numbers are increasing," she said. "A lot of it is to do with awareness and breaking down a lot of the stereotypes. Girls perhaps are not aware of the job opportunities and the progression in these sectors that have been predominantly male."
Special thing was all done by the field. hear the song of lovely Joan, her sound so sweet and clear. In the courtroom of the king, among children and the peers. I shall be of more service to thee than 300 salmon. The hay bounds across the page, past castles white and fair, to dreaming chessmen on their boards, for the fool's mates as a snare.
Deep Purple there, listen, learn, read on. 1968, we're talking a couple of stories to do with the University of Sheffield, all good stuff, eh? Just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up are this week's general environment update. Now, first story is a very, very interesting one indeed. And we're going to come on to talk about energy in the UK later on the show. So the UK has stopped producing electricity from burning coal, ending its 142-year reliance on the fossil fuel. The country's last coal power station at Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire finished operations on Monday after running since 1967. This marks a major milestone in the UK's ambitions to reduce its contribution to climate change. Now, coal is the dirtiest fossil fuel, producing the most greenhouse gases when burnt. The UK was the birthplace of coal power, and as of Tuesday it becomes the first major economy to give it up. Wow. So the first coal-fired power station in the world, the Holborn Viaduct Power Station, was built in 1882 in London by the inventor Thomas Edison, bringing light to the streets of the capital. From that point through the first half of the 20th century, coal provided pretty much all of the UK's electricity, powering homes and businesses. In the early 90s, coal began to be forced out of the electricity mix by gas, but coal still remained a crucial component of the UK grid for the next two decades. In 2012, coal still generated 39% of the UK's power. So as of today, coal produces none of that power. Amazing.
Wow. Net zero buildings. New building guidelines aim to cut the greenwash. Want a home that will help to save the planet? Welcome to a world of greenwashing and confusion, where spurious claims of zero bills, net zero or zero carbon could actually fall away, could fall way short of what you might expect. Now, Britain's first cross-industry standard for net zero buildings has launched with the aim of cutting through the noise.
Interesting. Welsh beavers. The Welsh government has given its support to plans to reintroduce beavers into the wild across the country. Beavers were once common across Wales, but due to hunting for their fur and meat, they became extinct after the Middle Ages. While small populations are already present in Wales, the new plans would grant the animals greater legal protections to safeguard future populations.
Green careers. According to the World Economic Forum, moving to a nature-positive economic model by 2030 would add 395 million jobs globally and unlock £7.5 trillion in business opportunities. New roles created could range from the biodiversity experts to eco-supply chain managers and jobs managing environmental projects.
Next up, melting glaciers. Aye. Switzerland and Italy are preparing to change their borders as melting alpine glaciers have altered their historically established frontier. The Swiss government certified changes to the border running beneath the Matterhorn, one of Europe's highest mountains, which separates the Zermatt region from the Val d'Aosta in Italy. According to the European Union, Copernicus Weather Service, glaciers in the Alps have lost 10% of their remaining volume over the last 2 years. Yikes. It's not good, is it? This is an interesting story, this next one. You've got this, Paul. I'm glad about that.
Yeah, it's not tiger balm. This is biblical balm. A thousand-year-old seed recovered from an archaeological dig in the Judean desert has grown into a 3-metre-tall plant that could be a source of a lost biblical balm. In the 1980s, researchers excavating a cave just north of Jerusalem discovered the ancient seed and cultivated it. They theorised that the tree could have been the source of an ancient commodity known as sori, or T-S-O-R-I, a resinous substance mentioned several times in the Bible that was prized for its medicinal properties.
Interesting. And a final one. Wood vaulting. The unearthing of a perfectly preserved 3,775-year-old log has offered new insights into a climate change mitigation technique known as wood vaulting. A team of researchers in Quebec analysed a log that had been buried under low permeability clay soil and found that it had lost less than 5% of the carbon from its original state. The discovery is likely to fuel efforts to turn wood vaulting, which is basically burying wood to stop its decomposition, into a viable and cost-effective climate solution.
So
beautiful track there. We didn't actually want to turn it off, did we?
Wow.
Joni Mitchell with Woodstock there, because in our environment update, we're talking about wood vaulting. Is that the way forward for climate solution, eh? Burying wood to stop its decomposition. If you just tuned in, of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital. If you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week. From 11 till 12 on Saturday mornings, all good stuff. So if you listen to that environment update, you'll hear us talk about coal power, and the UK has just stopped producing electricity from burning coal. It's just shut down Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire, that power station. Well, I saw another article. It was in the Sunday Times at the end of September. It's a fantastic article. It's a very big article. It's a 21,000-word essay on our infrastructure failings and how to fix them. The authors are Ben Southwood, Samuel Hughes and Sam Boom, and they cover what's wrong with the UK, from transport to housing to energy to investment. And I'm going to read what they say about energy. And I just thought, wow, here we go then. So as early as 1640, Britain was mining and burning three times more coal than the rest of Europe combined. Its use of coal to power the Industrial Revolution made it the world's first energy superpower. In the 20th century, Britain led another energy revolution. In 1932, John Cockcroft and Ernest Walton designed the first machine to split the atom, and that was in Cambridge. In 1956, Britain built the world's first nuclear power plant, supplying energy to homes. By 1965, Britain still had more nuclear reactors than the rest of the world put together. So each gram of uranium generates 3 million times more energy than a gram of coal. Unlike coal and gas, nuclear power doesn't cause air pollution or emit greenhouse gases. It uses 300 times less land than wind power, and its output is reliable and predictable. Nuclear is also remarkably safe. And they say even when you look at the Chernobyl disaster caused by the Soviet mismanagement, nuclear power's caused fewer deaths per megawatt hour than wind, whose turbine blades occasionally fall and engineers installing them. The remarkable implication of this is that the pathway to a net zero grid was wide open in the 1950s. All we had to do was build a fleet of nuclear power stations. France did exactly this, and it enjoys relatively cheap, clean energy to this very day. Instead, so the UK chose to rely on wind and solar power to decarbonise. These are attractive power sources in some ways, but they have a key problem. The power they produce varies wildly depending on how much wind or sunshine there is. There is so-called intermittency, which means we need a whole second system of non-intermittent power infrastructure. In practice, that means gas, for when they stop entirely. There's also a reverse problem on days with exceptionally abundant sunshine and wind, which creates a risk that the grid becomes overloaded, meaning we need to build more pylons and cables to cope with this surplus energy. These extra systems cost, and the direct subsidies we pay to wind and solar generators may add up to over £20 billion per year. Along with our decommissioning of coal and gas power plants, as we said earlier in the show, there are a core reason why in 2021 British businesses were paying 32% more for electricity than French ones and 74% more than American ones. The gap has only grown since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Without huge technological leaps in things like battery technology, there's little we can do about the high cost of intermittent renewables. But while nuclear power has also become very expensive, there are things we can do about that. South Korea currently builds nuclear power stations at 1/6 of the cost of the new reactor at Hinkley Point C. It has recently agreed to build reactors for Czechia for slightly over half as much as in the UK, and successfully built them in the United Arab Emirates for about half the cost. In part, our nuclear costs are astronomical because building nuclear is so risky for companies in the UK that their borrowing costs are enormous. In part, they are high due to decades of planning they take compared to 3 or 4 years elsewhere. And in part, they're because of redesign requirements. Sizewell B has been required to make 7,000 changes compared to the original design it replicates. All interesting stuff. Another cracking track there. Neighbourhood 3, Power Out by Arcade Fire. We talked about that because why Britain isn't working, and I talked about energy. That it's an absolutely cracking article. That it's a 21,000-word essay on our infrastructure failings and how to fix them. As I said earlier, the authors were Ben Southwood, Samuel Hughes and Sam Bowman, and that essay in full is the talk of Westminster, i.e. the government are thinking, oh, my word. And they don't just talk about energy, they talk about transport, housing, investment. It's fascinating read. I'm going to keep hold of it, in fact. Just tuned in. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We've got another story to go, then we'll have our PG on the line. Yay. He's waiting in the wings. He's going to be talking about sailing, possibly. All interesting stuff. Next up, a story I've had for quite a while now. It's titled Pioneering Test Finally Told Us What Was Wrong With Our Boy. Amanda Cole and her husband Rich from Tring in Hertfordshire had never been able to understand why Ben, age 5, had trouble with his strength, coordination and speech. And last year they were told for certain that he would never improve. A genetic test had shown why he hadn't reached development milestones. So the NHS is building a unique genetic database to help researchers and doctors understand a greater range of conditions. By June this year, the equivalent of 100,000 whole genomes, the entire genetic information of an individual, had been sequenced. Ben is one of the patients who have had their genomes sequenced by the groundbreaking NHS Genomic Medicine Service. By comparing Ben's DNA with that of his parents, scientists have identified that he has an ultra-rare mutation on one gene, known as the NF1X gene, which affects production of a vital protein for brain and muscle development. Ben's condition is known as Malan syndrome, that's M-A-L-A-N, which affects about 350 people worldwide, so it's quite a rare condition. Till last year's test results, his parents could not know why he was different. So Ben is now being welcomed by his fellow pupils at Grove Road Primary School in Tring, and because he's non-verbal, he signs using the Makaton system. Now, the NHS became the first health system in the world to use a whole genome sequencing service as part of routine care in 2020. A lot of other countries are looking to replicate what we are doing, so said Professor Dame Sue Hill, who's England's chief scientific officer. It's most definitely the future of healthcare. Now, new gene therapies for conditions such as spinal muscular atrophy and sickle cell disease are already being used by the NHS. These target faulty genes to reverse the symptoms to allow people to live normal lives. The number of these kind of treatments is expected to rise dramatically, partly as a result of greater genome testing and research by drug companies using specific drugs to target particular genes.
Off to the city, strung out on lasers and slashback blazers, and ate all your razors while pulling the waiters, talking about Monroe and walking on Snow White. New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice. Poor little greenie. Ooh. Get back on. Gene Genie lives on his back. Gene Genie loves chimney stacks. He's outrageous, he screams and he bawls. But Gene Genie, let yourself go. Smiles like a reptile. She loves him, but just for a short while. She'll scratch in the sand, won't let go his hand. He says he's a beautician, sells you nutrition, keeps all your dead hair for making up underwear. Poor little greenie. Loves chimney stacks.
simple-minded, can't drive his muffler, lights on the neon, and sleeps in a capsule. Loves to belong, loves to belong.
Cool, we've played some good stuff today, haven't we? That was the Gene Genie, of course, by David Bowie back in 72. We played that because we're talking about pioneering tests. Finally told us what was wrong with our boy. It was all about whole genome sequencing used by the NHS. Fantastic stuff. Isn't science amazing? Just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire. sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday from 11 till 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. Waiting in the wings on this very sunny Saturday morning.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, a few bits and pieces.
Oh. But,
I don't know what your memory's like, but a couple of times in recent years in Sheffield, we've turned out and after there's been a windy sort of passage and found the city covered in a red dust.
Yes.
And annoying for your car owners who had to clean their cars off and things. And it was tracked down as dust blown out from the Sahara. And by prevailing wind conditions, it arrived with us. And it's a bit of a nuisance. But news this week that it actually might be a bit more of a bonus than people realise.
Oh.
So there's a study being looking at the transfer of Saharan dust across the Atlantic. So as the dust picked and sort of carried across the Atlantic, it falls into the water. It happens to be iron rich, and at the moment the oceans are suffering from a bit of a shortage of iron. So the iron rich dust falls into the sea. That triggers the phytoplankton bloom, which then starts the whole sort of food chain and sort of enriches the sea. So from something that's a bit of a pain and you have to get your bucket and pail out to wash the car to something that's actually maybe helping the planet. So,
and your windowsills. And your windowsills and stuff, it gets everywhere.
It does, yes, yeah. You get your stone out on your front doorstep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just showing my age now, so I'm
I remember that as well, and the grandma used to do it.
it was one of those things that you always got told about that made life difficult back in the old days. But I think that's an interesting thing. There's a bit of a local link as well, because looking at the options and looking not too far across towards the ocean to Hull, there's going to be the Super Seagrass Festival returning to the city. So it's a part of a five-year project by the Wilder Humber Partnership to restore nearly 100 acres of protected habitats by planting seagrass.
Mm-hmm.
So the festival's taking place at the Deep in Hull on the 12th and 13th of October. And the organisers say it's a chance to learn how seagrass meadows benefit the marine environment and how plants store carbon and help to tackle climate change. And if you've been listening to the Prime Minister the last day or so, he's been saying what a wonderful opportunity carbon capture and storage is because of our geology, but this is something that's extended into the seas. So visitors are also going to be encouraged to help make up seagrass seed bags. So they're made out of Hessian sacking material, and they're going to be planted out at Spurn Point.
Oh, wow.
So as part of this five-year project, they want to restore nearly 100 acres of protected habitats. And that includes Yorkshire and Lincolnshire Wildlife Trusts, and a renewable energy firm, Ørsted. And they said that globally, seagrass captured carbon up to 35 times faster than tropical rainforests and also helped protect coastal areas from damaging storms and erosion.
Isn't that interesting? You know, there's all sorts of things coming out. Yeah, we've lost so many species and things, and it's not just plants and stuff, is it? It's species that actually do a lot of benefit, like beavers and stuff like that. They make a massive impact, but we've almost, you know, they're almost extinct in some places.
Yes, I think it's, I noticed that one of our guys on the station, Dale Lefebvre, had recorded something about, he's an American, so he was driving down to California and remembered how prolific monarch butterflies are, and sadly this year the count's massively down for things like monarch butterflies. So there are changes, but there are people fighting. Project, I think Katie Duke, the chief executive of the Deep, said the festival provides an opportunity for visitors to contribute to restoration project. Last year, they saw 2,000 seed bags created over the course of a weekend, and they hope to beat that this time. So a marine program manager at Yorkshire Wildlife Trust said that involving the local community in seagrass restoration was essential for safeguarding this vital habitat in years ahead. So they also added they'd seen a rise in the number of species making use of the Wilder Humber seagrass meadows. At Spurn Point, including the critically endangered European eel. So, again, some groups of things in the news. And one of the things that sort of caught my eye as well is, again, we talked a while ago about Dimorphos, this sort of asteroid that was heading towards Earth, and we sent a mission to try and deflect it. And now they're going to send another mission to look at Dimorphos, and it's from a Belfast-based astronomer taking part in a European Space Agency planetary defence mission. It's going to be called the Hera mission, and Hera, I think, is goddess of the heavens and wife and daughter, I think, of Zeus.
Ooh.
So,
well, I've learned something there, then. That's not my strong point, I'm afraid.
But this is Professor Alan Fitzsimmons at the Astrophysics Research Centre at Queen's University in Belfast. he's going to be on ground control for the mission, the HERA mission, and it's going to be launched from Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral.
Oh, wow.
And it's scheduled later this month to take off. And it's a satellite, but also with a set of miniature satellites called CubeSats, which we've talked again about in other things. But what they want to do is, they say it's a bit like a real-life arcade game. They want to know if you could deflect asteroids away from Earth. And the mission that I think NASA sent up last year, Dimorphos, and they had a satellite crash into it, and they physically could manage to recover the shift. So they're saying, yeah, the base there for that. So this is a follow-up to that mission, and they're saying that astrophysicists have found more than 35,000 near-Earth asteroids, and of these, there are something like 1,600 to 1,700 that are large enough and pass close to us to have to be continuously monitored on a risk list. So these is anticipated to hit Earth in the next 100 years. Hooray! But I'm more concerned about future asteroids that could do what happened to the dinosaurs and wipe out things as we know it. So the NASA DART mission was back in September 22, so yeah, it's a couple of years ago now. And that was the one that tried to kinetically impact crashing a small satellite into the asteroid to see if that would put it off course, which, I say, it did manage to make it deviate from its course. So, kind of interesting stuff happening in space. And I think sort of one of the other things that I looked at was, again, something that we touched on a while ago, and it was a new space sail that was sent up by NASA, and it sort of recently landed space.
Oh, hey there, Paul. I thought I'd lost you. Sorry. I thought he'd turned you off.
No, it's my computer's jumping about. So
is this the new computer or your old one?
No, this is a wobbly old one.
Oh.
This new state-of-the-art solar sail is in Earth's orbit, and it's now noticed that it's tumbling and wobbling a little bit, although some movement was expected from it. But it's called the Advanced Composite Solar Sail System, or ACS3, and it aims to test the efficiency of a new type of solar sail. So it's a device that's potentially capable of propelling spaceships faster than currently available speeds, just using radiation pressure exerted by sunlight. So this is a space version of the old sailing ship. And this new technology they sent out, it falls out from a small cube into an 860 square foot or 80 square meter foil sail.
Wow.
it was sort of quite an achievement. It's tightly folded up within a box about the size of a microwave oven, known as CubeSat. And it deploys from that using a new set of folding booms, which are made of, again, a brand new composite material that's 75% lighter and more resistant to solar radiation than the frames that have been used on previous solar sails. So they've been put in space by Russia, Japan and NASA and some private companies already. But the ACS-3 was successfully launched on the 23rd of April. And that was on board a private rocket, Rocket Labs Electron rocket, that flew from a launch in New Zealand. So it's positioned in low Earth orbit, which again we were talking about last week and the week before. And so it's going to actually be around 600 miles above our planet surface, and it remains there while it's sorting itself out and unfurling this surface. It is one of the things to talk about deep space exploration now, is rather than packing fuel for rockets, to use something like a solar sail to capture this energy that's coming out from the sun.
Ah, that's what it's all about then, is it?
Yeah, and harness that as a propulsion for spacecraft. So
interesting.
Again, it's another way of extending the travel out into the further reaches of space. And it's very, very efficient, and looks like they're saying that within these tests that it can propel a spacecraft faster than the rocket-powered ones that we've put into space so far. So, great bit of technology, and again, a clever use of materials and science to achieve it. NASA's version of this, that when it unfurled, it got itself in a bit of a tangle and took some sorting out. So they are very complex devices to unpack in space. So I think to get out of the Earth's atmosphere, you're going to use a lot of power. So they try and make it into a small package to minimize the amount of power. So it's not like we're sending a manned capsule size beast into space. It's much smaller, but to achieve that, it's a very complex, bit like a giant origami. you get it into space, and slowly it will unpack and unfurl itself into a giant solid sail. Saying solid, it's very much like a tinsel sort of type material, but it's going to pick up that radiation. And again, looking in news this week, there's going to be a massive solar flare in the near future, and it could be an event where the magnetic field of the sun switches. So it can have some effect, but it does release a lot of power. And we do get a lot of that power, and you can get it on Earth. It used to be in the old days of a sort of AM radio that you get noises on the radio produced by the waves that are emitted from the sun during a solar flare. So it's one of the things. In extreme cases, if you're not careful, you get electromotive force, EMF, and that can really destroy electronic systems. So a lot of the time, you've got to try and protect things like aircraft in flight to make sure that they aren't susceptible to that kind of power from solar radiation near on. But equally, this new process is looking to set sail into deep space.
Oh, set sail, eh?
So I think it's a good analogy to the old sort of sailing craft. And again, if you want to look at the news this week, we're going to put a sailing craft up for the Admiral's Cup, aren't we? I think the America's Cup that started out 1851. I think round the Isle of Wight, and we've never won it. We qualified for it once before in the 60s, but we just qualified again to be in to see if we can actually win the cup for the first time in 150 years. So, as a sailing nation, I thought it's an interesting thing for everybody to look at how that's now transferring into
space. Amazing stuff, and it's a great excuse to play that classic track from Who, do we think? Rod Stewart, eh? I hadn't heard it for ages. Great stuff, yeah. Paul, as always. We shall speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sailing home again, across the sea. I am sailing stormy waters to be near you, to be free. I am sky. I am flying, passing high clouds to be near you, to be free. Can you hear me? Can you hear me through the dark?
Rod Stewart there, sailing. I really haven't heard that for a long time. We played that because RPG was talking about, amongst other things, solar sails. Isn't it all interesting stuff? Just tuned in. You listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. The film shore in the house, outside, waiting to get in.
There's four today.
There's four people, eh? How popular it's are they? Let's hope they're happy as well this they week. Are, they're not always happy, are they to be fair? Anyway, we've just got time for one last quick story. It's about trees. So trees are valuable allies in fighting climate change, absorbing CO2, that's carbon dioxide from the air, and locking the carbon away in their tissues. But a new study reveals that tree bark also provides another vital climate service by absorbing methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas with levels that are increasing rapidly from agriculture, landfills and much else. So microbes hidden in the bark of the trees can eat up methane to use for their energy needs. And this is a phenomenon well known in soils, which are full of microbes that absorb and break down methane. So the soil has been thought of as the only land-based sink for getting rid of methane. But estimates from the latest studies reveal that microbes in tree bark can soak up vast amounts of methane on a scale equal to or even greater than the microbes in the soil, adding a new dimension to natural strategies for helping get rid of climate change gases. So the study also found that the higher up a tree, the stronger the methane absorption. So the trees were studied from various places, Sweden, England, Panama and the Amazon, with the strongest methane absorption found in tropical forests, probably because microbes thrive in warm, wet conditions. Now, microbes living on trees take up 25 million to 50 million metric tons of methane each year, adding up to about 10% to the climate benefit that all temperate and tropical trees provide. Another fascinating statistic came from measurements of the tree dimensions using laser scanning. So detailed they can even include the smallest twigs. This revealed that if the bark of all the world's trees were laid out flat, it would be equal to the entire Earth's land surface, representing a vast surface area for trees to soak up methane. But relying solely on the power of trees, as well as other natural strategies to soak up man-made greenhouse gases, is not nearly enough to combat climate change. Greenhouse gas emissions still need to be curbed, and urgently. All interesting stuff. That's all we've got time for today. We're going to play out with a track from Faust. It was off an album called The Faust Tapes. It's called The Boom or The Tree. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.